This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Just a few hundred yards from where I sit in the Vermont Public Radio station in Colchester is the Vermont Islamic Society. It is there where, just a few years ago, four young women became friends. As we were covering news and holding membership drives, these four girls bonded and at some point became known as Muslim Girls Making Change. They're a slam poetry team, but they're a lot more than that. And they're our guests today on Vermont Edition. They're all here with us, and I'm going to ask you to introduce yourselves.
Hi, my name is Walkisa.
My name is Karen.
My name is Lena.
And I'm Hawa.
And we're Muslim Girls Making Change.
M-G-M-C.
That was somewhat spontaneous, somewhat practiced.
All right. Always practiced. Yeah.
So I mentioned a little bit about how you met. So, Balkisa, tell us a little more.
Well, we all attend the same Sunday school, and we see each other all the time through there. And then there's also, we all attend other events that happen at the mosque. And so that's how we really got to know each other a whole lot. Now they're not even friends anymore. They're considered family to me.
Wow.
Yes.
And Kieran, was it an immediate bond between the four of you?
It's kind of like messy because Lena and I were family friends. I met Hal in sixth grade and we knew each other, and then Hal introduced Balkisa to us when she used to go to Burlington. They were friends. So I mean, it kind of was because there aren't very many Muslims around, so we could talk about these things that no one else could, and we had, it's kind of like inside jokes all the time.
Yeah.
Well, Lena, yeah, why these three others? Why the four of you?
I don't know. I guess we had this kind of connection between all of us. I mean, we all related through the same problem. We're all, like, going through the same problems, I guess. Or we're going through, like, we have, like, a lot of inside jokes that, like, connect us. And I don't know. It was just a click, you know? Whenever we talk with each other,
There's no lull in conversation.
Right, yeah. We're so comfortable with each other. It's all laughs and love and everything's great.
But Hawa, two of you go to Burlington. Two of you go to South Burlington High School. So... Rivalries, high school rivalries?
All the time. Yeah.
Obviously,
yeah,
SB is sure. Better. Come on.
Come on. Burlington? No, I used to go to South Burlington, so I do know their school pretty well, and now I go to Burlington. So there's a little tension sometimes, but it's all fun and games.
But what matters is that she represents Burlington High School now.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
All right. And so how did that friendship among you four become Muslim Girls Making Change, Balkisa?
Well, so we had, like, this youth group formed because we were, like, we're teenagers now, and it's that time where we need each other's support. And so we created that group not just to support each other, but also to, like, challenge stereotypes about Muslims and, like, just who we are. And so that happened, and then we all fell in love through poetry, and then that's how Muslim Girls Making Change established.
Okay, so poetry. Kieran.
Yes.
Why and how is poetry the medium that became the way you amplify the message that you have for people?
I mean, I just think that, like, with poetry, like, especially slam poetry, there aren't, like, these specific rules. You can do so much with it. And, like, I've seen such great poems where, like, they use their bodies in certain ways, or their, like, the tone of their voice and all these different emotions. And, like, I've always been taught that, like, actions speak louder than words. But if you don't, you know, these words that have such power, and like if you, it educates people and, like, can move people to, like, certain emotions and feelings, and it really gets you, like, to connect with different people.
Mm-hmm. And Lena, explain, because there's one thing, I mean, people know poetry, mm-hmm. but what is slam poetry? How is that different?
Well, slam poetry is different because you get to express yourself through your words, and you get to work and play around with different words to just get it right. And, you know, you have these awesome coaches that help you out throughout your journey, throughout this whole poetry idea. And it's great because you get to express yourself in a way, and it's just a great experience overall.
Okay, so you've got four people trying to write together. Kieran, what is the writing process like?
I mean, we do separate pieces by ourselves, and we also do ones, like, where three of us will write one, three of us write another one. But it can be very chaotic because since we are such good friends, we get off topic very, very easily. So it will take us, once we settle down and we actually get into the poetry, it flows because we have all these awesome ideas that come from different people that you would never even thought about yourself. So it just kind of all works together somehow.
Had you been writing poetry on your own before this?
No.
Any of you?
Yeah, we have.
The other three.
Balkisa and I have been doing a lot of poetry together.
And so, Lena, like, who has to kind of run things when there's arguments or, you know, disagreements on a word, a topic? Who takes charge here?
I guess it's kind of all of us at the same time.
Just kind of argue.
But like sometimes one of us would be like, hey, let's do this. Like everyone quiet down. We got to get started. Mostly Hala takes charge. She is really good with poetry. But it's usually all of us. And we have to get stuff done. Usually we're like, hey, yo, we got to get stuff done. We have to get, you know, we got to do this. So it's like, it's all of us, you know.
So it's a very democratic process, Hala?
Right.
Or do you just become the dictator at some point?
No, I'm never really quite that.
No, yeah, no.
All right, so let's talk about poetry in 2016 for sophomores in high school. Is it relevant at all? There are other forms of media and entertainment that people can turn to. Does anybody care about poetry in your age group?
I mean, from
other
what
than the four of you.
Right. From what I've seen a lot of youth participating in poetry, but I've also seen not as many. You know, poetry is something that, you know, all four of us love, and this is a way of expressing ourselves and voicing in our, you know, our words that we've wanted to say. And I mean, this is something we love, and it's, I know for our age, we're not really into this kind of stuff. You know, we're all about, like, social media and, you know, just chilling, watching
Netflix. That's the perception.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you see people like us getting in through poetry, people are like, you know, it's kind of interesting. I want to get into that. And it's kind of a way of, like, portraying our message of saying not only, like, with our problems we face through the, like, you know, through media with Muslims, but it's also portraying the way, like, people should get involved with poetry because it's something that really we really connect with, and it's something great.
And I feel like a lot of time, when people say, like, if you say the word poetry to, like, a 10th grader, most of the time, like, they're so used to, like, having, like, oh, that's, like, old stuff. I don't even understand what they're saying. Like, it's all over my head.
Shakespeare.
Yeah. But then, like, when they see, like, we share a bunch of our videos on Facebook, and, like, or if we, like, just, like, perform in front of people, they say, oh, I get that. That's in simple words. I can, like, that's, like, that's language I use. I understand what they're saying. I feel like that's important. And so if they, like, I feel if someone sees what we're doing and, like, hears it, and, like, hears slam poetry, then they're like, okay, yeah, I like this.
We're talking with Balkisa, Hala, Lena, and Kieran. They are Muslim girls making change. In just a few minutes, they're going to perform one of their poems. Listeners, if you're a poet or a poetry reader, we'd love to hear from you. Send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net. I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. Our studio is bubbling with energy today. I'm joined by Lena Ghanawi, Kieran Wakar, Balkisa Abdikadir, and Hala Adam. They are Muslim Girls Making Change. Mm. They are a group of friends. They are a slam poetry group. They are a quartet of young people who take steps in their daily lives to make the world a better place. Mm. Well, Kieran, you've set us up perfectly for your performance.
Oh, no.
Is that you, Lena?
No,
okay. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, I'll be quiet.
Alright. September 11, 2001.
Wake up, America. The enemy is here.
The terrorists.
Jihadists.
The Arabs.
The womanizers.
Monsters.
Bin Ladens.
The ones to watch out for.
Surveil.
To remove.
To attack.
But actually, we're the advocates.
The award winners.
The bilinguals.
Hello.
Hola.
Bonjour.
Guten Tag.
Assalamu alaikum.
We're the 4.0 students.
Honor roll students.
The star athletes.
But we're also the misunderstood. The ones to watch out for.
To watch out for.
To surveil.
To surveil.
To remove.
To remove.
To attack.
To attack.
It was my first day of 10th grade. My first day with the hijab in public. This hijab that had the power to turn me from Kieran Wakar, typical teen, to Kieran Wakar, ambassador for all 1.6 billion Muslims.
March 21st, 2003.
Fireworks were thrown into a Palestinian's family van.
Flames burned brighter than the rocket's red glare.
America, what are you celebrating? April
6, 2004. A woman's hijab ripped off and she was verbally assaulted.
But she's dangerous, right? She deserves this.
Right?
Wait. But it's her body.
Right.
A woman should be able to do what they want.
Right. So if you can show, why can't we conceal? August 6, 2007,
a chemical bomb is thrown at a mosque in Glendale, Arizona.
The bomb almost hit two Muslim Americans.
Imagine what could have happened.
Two mothers could have lost their sons. Two men
could have lost their lives.
But wait.
America, you don't care about our protection. Because you're trying to protect yourselves from us.
From me. I was on my way home from school and you decided to cross to the other side of the street. Was the surface I walked on too hot for you to come near? Did you know that your looks flamed the fire of insecurities within me?
August 24th, 2010.
A taxi driver picks up Michael Enright, his first passenger of the day.
He thinks it'll be an average ride until he uttered the word Muslim.
Michael Enright slashes the taxi driver's face. Not once. Not twice.
What a price to pay for the freedom of your rights. What happened to our freedom of religion?
Promise to you. And you. And you.
And me? What about me? It's the first day of school. I'm the only Muslim girl wearing the hijab. I can feel everyone's eyes razor sharp. Their lips forming questions. Who knew curiosity could cut so deep? I just wanted to curl up in a corner.
February 10, 2010.
Imagine you're a Muslim, going to your house of prayer and seeing the words, Muslim, go home, dripping in red paint on the white walls.
Go home, they said, go home where?
The hospital I was born?
The city that I was raised?
We're not just Muslims.
We're American Muslims, equal in every way.
I heard the words roll off his tongue, you Muslims are the reason why the airport lines are so long, you bombers. He was drunk, but a drunk mind speaks a sober heart.
These are the things we see, hear, and experience daily.
And now you know of these.
Hidden crimes.
Unheard voices.
Terror on Muslims.
Restless souls.
Guns and bullet holes.
Wake up, America. The enemy has always been here.
Belkisa, that's called Wake Up America, is that correct?
Yeah, that's called Wake Up America.
All right, so how did that get written? How did it start and get put together? Because that is stunning. Who wants to answer?
I guess. I mean, it's kind of like we've seen this. All of us have seen all of these crimes. Well, we haven't really heard of them. Many people haven't heard of these crimes.
Including us. Like, we didn't even know about all of these.
So that's why these are hidden crimes. And we found out we need to voice out these crimes and that they should not be hidden. Because the Muslim community is kind of impacted by these hidden crimes because not many people know of these, of what's going on. And through this poem, we tried to portray what was going on.
And like the dates we said were actual events that nobody is aware of. Like all the dates we were listing are things that happened.
And we tried to incorporate like our own experiences within that as well.
Now this would have been powerful written on the page, but you decided to perform it, and it seems like it comes to life for people. So, Kieran, why that decision that this has to be performed, not just written?
I mean, I feel like you can do so much more with like your body and your voice than just like words on a page, because words on a page are just still words on a page. When you see an actual human being like breathing and like performing this piece, it like humanizes it. You're like, wait, this isn't just like a story or like something that might happen. It's actually happening, and these are people who can actually say this is happening.
Hawa, when this is performed, I'm sorry, live, what is the reaction you get from people? What have people said to you after they watch and hear this?
A lot of compliments. They're always like, that was great. You know, a lot of people mentioned that, you know, they relate to it, and like a lot Muslims and non-Muslims alike, you know, they've been through certain struggles like these, and, you know, so a lot of people can really relate and make connections with it. And it's just been so amazing because, like, everybody's, like, been so supportive about it. Mm-hmm. And they've been, like, complimenting us and just saying how great of a job we're doing that we should keep going with it.
Go ahead, Lena.
Yeah, and I was going to say also, we've never received any backlash, and we weren't really surprised with that because knowing that we live in a state in Vermont, we know that we're very comfortable here voicing out our opinions, mm-hmm. and that we've not received any backlash, and it's been great so far.
Well, let me ask you this more personally, because I'd like to think Vermont is the perfect place where everyone is treated properly. Right. And it's easy for me. I'm a short, fat, bald guy, Harry Potter glasses. I mean, I fit in. I no one sees me. But the four of you, female, darker skin, you're wearing the hijab, you get noticed immediately wherever you are in Vermont,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So how are you treated here, Belkisa? And you can all answer this.
Okay.
Happily, I can say I've never the like one-on-one, somebody's never come up to me or told me, oh, like all these stereotypes. Yeah, it happened, but it was like, it was more like they didn't like, they did it, but it wasn't like said to me, you know? And I've been here most of my life, and so I'm really comfortable with it.
Where were you born?
I was born in Kenya, but I came here when I was 2 years old.
Kieran?
I feel like Vermont's like pretty good, because I mean, I feel more people are like willing to listen and question you and like ask questions, which I definitely encourage, because information is never bad. And I feel like it's more of like those microaggressions where people like give you the weird stares and think you'd be like, oh, that's another person, which creates a divide, which is like problematic. But it's not direct. It's there, but it's not as bad as you would think it is.
Lena? Yeah. Also knowing that, you know, we are the minority here in Vermont. And I mean, it's kind of it like we are the minority, but it doesn't feel like it, because I feel like we've connect with a lot of people here in Vermont, and everyone's very supportive, and they ask us a lot of questions. But it's nothing too like, oh, like, you know, too like harsh. It's it's something that like oh why do you wear the hijab or something like this, and it's something because they're curious. It's not like they're trying to be ignorant. So in a way, it's great. And you know, Vermont's a great place to live here, because I've never seen, you know, as they've said, experienced this like firsthand, but we know it's there. Like as we've said in the poem, we've experienced it maybe once or twice in our lives that we've lived in Vermont, but not as much as we
Hawa.
Yeah, so most of the poem is about, like, other people experiencing it, because we don't necessarily, like, it's not, like, a big deal. We don't, like, really see a lot of, like, things happening to us here besides what they mentioned, you know, like, little small microaggressions that, like, don't really, well, in our eyes, maybe mean something, like, because... Mm-hmm.
Well, the one line in the poem about someone crossing the street, right, that isn't overt, but... You feel it, right?
Yeah, we still feel it. Yeah. We're still human.
Like, I feel like it's just like when you make a when you have these microaggressions, and when people like start to think of you as like another person, it makes us so much more it makes us so much easier to do horrible things to them, because they aren't human, they aren't you. So this like divide that's the thing I feel like Vermont should work on. But I think it's way better than some other places.
Yeah.
Well, we are in the middle of. Presidential campaign. There's a lot of political rhetoric being tossed around this campaign. So, Lena, you know, how do you feel when you hear some of the things that are said by people who want to become president
She's
of the United States
talking
of America?
Now.
No,
I picked the right person. Yeah.
Well, honestly, seeing these arguments that's going on, and knowing that we're a part of these, like, we're not part of it, but we're talked about in these arguments. Knowing that it's kind of sad to see this. You know, it's sad to see that they're arguing about pointless things that should not be a big problem. That this should not be like, oh, Muslims should be banned or whatever, you know, whatever they've been going on about. But this is not something that should affect us, because we don't really want to go on and focus on the negative views of these politicians. We want to focus on our voices as what we're doing through in poetry. And it's not really much, you know, focusing on the negative. It's like we're kind of getting onto their level. I mean, yeah, we should like understand that this is a problem, but fighting back against it is a better way through poetry in a more peaceful way. And
I'm almost glad like we have this going on, actually, right. because it gives us this chance.
Exactly.
You know, we wouldn't be able to express our writing, our voices, if this wasn't happening. You know, we'd just be like, oh, everything's fine. You know, nothing's going on in the world. You know, we're fine.
But like with this, don't get we have voice. A reason.
Right. Yeah. So we have a reason to get other people's voices as well as ours into the media, as well as like just.
So something so subtle, so artistic as poetry is, Balkisa, your way of pushing back.
Yeah, definitely. And also, like Kieran was saying earlier, like when we're standing right in front of them, like not only do we help them like understand it, but they also feel it through our facial expressions, our body movements, and such as.
Now, I'd like to think that this is all you've done and it's pretty fabulous. But Muslim Girls Making Change actually have gotten involved in several other things. So let's start with Kieran. I think you and Lena have worked on something together.
Yeah, as a group, we've done like tons of volunteer projects like Ronald McDonald House, Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program. But Lena and I, along with Ali Barrett and Dina Elsafar and our wonderful mentor, Nancy Levarme, like we would be lost without her. But we did a blanket drive for blanket and winter clothing drive for Syrian refugees displaced within Syria.
And why did you do this? How was it received?
it was received like, amazingly. People in Vermont are so willing to give up, like they step up and just like they make a change. And I think that we did it just to raise awareness about it, because when you see like your donations going to like actual people, or you can think about them as actual people, not statistics, it can make a giant difference.
Yeah, and to see that like we have so much and they have very little, it's something like we want to give back, you know, because we've had so much. We want to help others who don't really have as much, you know, seen through Syrian refugees, which is why we took on this project and, you know, to help out. And this is one of many problems we have here in the world. I mean, this is one we wanted to take on. And
she actually wrote a poem about that too.
Yeah.
Can you recite it?
No, I don't know, it's not really fun, honestly.
Okay. No problem.
But we'd also like to thank, sorry, just thank BPR, because that's actually the reason that it got big. So you thank guys, you guys, yeah, though.
We did an interview here, like, I think in February.
Yeah.
And that's what got, like, the Peter Shumlin, he got, that got his attention. And, like,
so you guys know, have a good giant part of this.
Yeah.
No, it's you.
No.
Hawa and Balkisa, I think you've worked on a project together as well. Am I correct about this?
Yeah. Before
Tell me about it, Hawa.
Yeah. So before we started the poetry group with us four, Balkisa and I were doing a separate thing at school, and we're part of START at School, stands for Students Taking Actions and Risks Together. It's a drug, alcohol, prescription, drug prevention program. And we've been constantly going back to city council meetings, trying to convince them that there should be a smoking ban placed in Burlington Parks and Beaches areas. And so with that, you know, regularly we just write like a speech whenever we went there. One time I just decided, you know, we should really write a poem. And I was like, I kind of just started it off, and then Balkisa and I just finished it together, and I was like, okay, you gotta perform this with me. Then we went there, we read it to them, and they were very moved by it, and we kept going back and reading it to them to inspire them and to get them to like push it forward.
We also submitted it to a poetry and essay contest, and we won it, and we were invited to read on the steps of the State House, which is really exciting.
This is so great. Okay, so I'm gonna go right through the line. We still have a few more minutes. What poets, artists, musicians, authors, do you look up to and emulate? Can I start with you, Balkisa?
There's a lot, but Bono Muhammad definitely inspired me.
Why is that?
Mm-hmm. Because just the way he says it, and like I can relate to all his poetry really well.
Mm-hmm. Kieran?
I can't even choose them. Like I'm just thinking of like everyone I've seen like perform in BNB, like on those like videos on YouTube, like those girls, like all the girls and guys, like everyone there, just like all the like the teens, like were like willing to like get their voice out there. It's kind of scary. So everyone's just anyone.
I can't wait for Lena's answer, because she is twisting in her chair.
Yeah. I can't think of anything. Okay, does it have to be a writer or
anything?
It does
not.
No. Okay, I guess
it could be me. If you want to say that it's me, you can say that.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's a boxer. Muhammad Ali.
Oh,
you know him. I kind of really look up to his words and his wisdom and his strength, especially the way he fights through these, you know, especially because he's Muslim and he fights through this stereotypical ideas, and he can fight through these, not only like using fists and stuff, you know, it's boxing, but like through his words, especially. I look up to his like wisdom and his way of like going throughout life.
And you got to remember, so I grew up as knowing him at first as Cassius Clay, and then he became a Muslim,
right.
And that was very difficult in the 1960s for someone to change their name, who was a popular figure. It was pretty incredible. Yeah. And Hawa, how about you?
I don't have a specific person in mind right now. I think just anybody, like Kieran said, anybody I listen to, really. I mean, I would say like the BNV youths, but I don't know. There's this poem called Speaking Broken English, or Three Ways to Speak English, and the writer that wrote that was very inspiring to me.
All right. Well, talk about inspiring. I've been speaking with Lena Ghanawi, Kieran Wakar, Balkisa Abdikadir, and Hawa Adam. They are the Muslim Girls Making Change. And if you want to learn more about them, we have a link on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. MGMC, thank you so much for joining us here on Vermont Edition. Coming up, a very large, somewhat famous painting in St. Johnsbury is due for an elaborate restoration and will honor a once maligned but now well-loved stringed instrument, the ukulele. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Prepare to be overwhelmed by the grandeur of Yosemite when you walk into the St. Johnsbury Athenaeum, The library, art gallery, and museum is a fixture in town, and within the building, Albert Bierstadt's painting, The Domes of Yosemite, is a striking piece in the collection. But this painting is now nearly 150 years old, and it's showing its age. Host Jane Lindholm spoke with Athenaeum director Bob Jolly recently to talk about the painting and what it needs to be taken down and sent away for repairs.
For people who haven't seen this painting in its place in the Athenaeum, describe what you walk into and see and how it feels to be in the room.
It's on the back wall of the gallery, so you're about 40 feet away from it, but the painting is huge. It's 9.5 feet tall and 15 feet wide, and it's looking into Yosemite Valley from the location. It's about halfway up Yosemite Falls, so you're looking at this grand view down into the valley from an elevated point of view. So it's physically very big, and then the view that it presents is of a wide open valley with Yosemite Falls on one side and Half Dome on the other, and then other peaks across the range.
And it's sort of photorealism. So does it feel like an immersive experience when you're standing there looking at it?
It does. And it has this really curious quality. And we will have people do this. You'll make a cup of your two hands, put them in front of your face. So you're looking through your mostly closed fist. And you look at the painting, and it becomes three-dimensional. It's a very odd quality.
And people do that? Like they're looking through binoculars almost?
Yes. It's almost like you're pretending, like you're a child and you're looking through your fists at, you know, pretending you're seeing something far away. But it has a very strange quality when you look at it. But it is a very funny phenomenon.
Now, Albert Bierstadt was born in Germany and he was raised on the East Coast. So how did he come to have what clearly is an affection for this Western landscape?
Though a lot of the Hudson River painters, so-called, and it was a derogatory term when it was first applied, as if to say, you guys just paint the first thing you see when you float up the river. A lot of those painters did that. They painted in New York and the environs, but they were going west essentially as the country was. So Thomas Moran, for instance, is as well known for his Colorado paintings as Bierstadt is for California paintings, but they were really just following the trend of this westward migration. And I think they were so astonished by the sights there, they really wanted to capture them, both because they're grand, but also to show them to people on the East Coast, as if to say, you won't believe what's out there.
Bierstadt painted this in 1867, I believe, right?
Yes.
So how did it come to be in the Athenaeum's collection?
That is a curious story. It was commissioned for a financier in Norwalk, Connecticut, LeGrand Lockwood. And it was in his house. And for all intents and purposes, that's where it was going to stay. He, LeGrand Lockwood, became bankrupt in the gold devaluation in 1869. He actually dies, probably of the related stress, in 1872. Horace Fairbanks is building the Athenaeum. The library was completed in 1871. It took 2 years to build the gallery. And he, because he was in New York a lot, I think heard about this painting was going to become available through LeGrand Lockwood's estate, and built what we believe he built the back wall to hold this painting. And I've often wondered, why didn't it stay closer to New York City or southwestern Connecticut? It's so big, I suspect Fairbanks wasn't competing with a lot of people to buy the painting. It's so big, it wasn't going to fit everywhere. So I think he was completing his collection. This was obviously going to be the centerpiece of the collection, but it's essentially an accident that it came here.
How much did he have to pay for it? It might have been devalued if he didn't have to compete very hard, but...
Yes, he also got an excellent bargain. He paid $5,100. LeGrand Lockwood had paid $25,000.
Oh, wow.
So, yep, he was a good business person as well. And it was either a Boston or a New York paper that said something like, disparagingly, oh, it will astonish the natives. That's how they refer to those of us who were up here then, leaving the environs of civilization and going to God knows where.
But since the 1870s, it's been in St. Johnsbury and it's been in the Athenaeum.
Mm-hmm.
And now it needs some work. What's been happening to the painting?
I guess I would basically say, if you use the car analogy, it's going in to fix the timing belt before the timing belt breaks and you're stranded. It'll be 150 years old next year. It is a very large, single piece of canvas. It needs to be backed to support the original cannabis. It's been standing in its frame since it came here in 18 and went on display in 1873. And it's had work over the years. The varnish has been removed and replaced. It's had a bit of inpainting. The stretcher has been adjusted, so it's had work over the years, but this is essentially, you know, we've got to do major work on it so that it looks great for the next 75 years.
But just to do these repairs is going to cost 20 times what Horace Fairbanks paid for this painting more than 100 years ago. Now, of course, we have inflation, but this is just for the repairs, $100,000. How are you going to pay for that?
It will take a lot of fundraising. It will take a direct appeal to some of our supporters who like the Athenaeum and understand our mission and support the works that are here. We will be doing a very broad-based campaign because this is something that is not certainly in our operating budget. So it's just a huge fundraising undertaking, and we've done this periodically. All of the trustees who have been here and the directors have raised money over the years for different conservation projects. This happens to be the single biggest one we'll take on.
For now, though, people can still see this painting. It's not gone.
Yes, and it's important to make that point. It should be here for more than another year for two reasons. Number one, we have to raise the money. We can't simply send it out and incur the debt and then figure out how to finance it. But also, we want it to leave here in this building, which is not climate controlled, in a period, and that would be probably October, when it's most like the conservation studio it's going to. So we would like the humidity to be low and the temperature to be comfortable for people, which is also very comfortable for paintings. So it'll be here probably until October or November of 2017. So it is on display. It is pulled away from the wall so the conservators could get behind it. And we're going to leave it in that position because it sort of helps with the fundraising message. But it is going to be here for another year.
And then it just gets, what, rolled up? I mean, how do you deal with something that's that big?
Yeah, you disassemble it here in the Athenaeum. It will be put on the floor. And the way these very big paintings are handled is they're rolled on a big sonnen tube, which is basically what you pour concrete into for huge buildings. The tube is wrapped with a material which protects the painting. The painting is interleaved, and then the painting is literally rolled around this gigantic tube, and then sort of a protective layer is put over the entire painting, and then out it goes.
Oh, man, that would make me so nervous if I had to watch that process.
It will make me very nervous. When we moved the painting away from the wall, I thought, oh, I should call the media and I should invite people to see this. And then I said, no, I should wait until it's done. And then I should tell people it's moved. What I didn't want was great photographs of it having a problem.
Right. So we shouldn't expect a big media scrum at the rolling party either.
At the rolling party, because by then it'll be safe. When it's literally coming out of its frame and it's extremely nerve-wracking, the part once it's down on the floor and it's been protected from the issues that it needs to be protected from, then I think it'll be extremely exciting. I mean, literally getting this giant tube out of the building will be a sight to see, but knowing that it's this painting which is leaving and that it will be gone for probably 3 or 4 months, so both leaving and returning will be a pretty exciting thing to see.
Is there any chance that the Athenaeum will get climate control if that's one of the things that's a problem for this painting?
That's the other thing we're working on. While this painting is gone, we will climate control the space that it's coming back to. So ideally, it's coming back in a great condition, and it's going back into a much better space. An old building like this is hard to bring up to, say, newly built museum standards, but we can improve it a lot, and that's our goal. So that's part of the fundraising package, is to climate control the gallery space.
Bob, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jane. It was a pleasure.
Bob Jolly, director of the St. Johnsbury Athenaeum, talking with VPR's Jane Lindholm. Albert Bierstadt's quite large oil painting, Domes of Yosemite, is still in place at the Athenaeum for at least a year before it goes out for repairs. You can learn more and see photos at vpr.net.